Our dreams offer mysterious clues as to how our minds work, and research has shown that it is possible to learn from our dreams and even to control them. Today's edition of Please Explain looks at how dreams are studied, what they reveal about us, and what therapies can help people cope with nightmares and other sleep disorders. Joining us are Deirdre Barrett, Assistant Clinical Professor of Psychology in Harvard Medical School Psychiatry Department and author of Supernormal Stimuli, How Primal Urges Overran Their Evolutionary Purpose, among other books, and Rosalind Cartwright, Professor Emeritus in the Division of Neuroscience at Rush University Medical Center, author of The 24-Hour Mind, The Role of Sleep and Dreaming in Our Emotional Lives. Welcome to our show.
Thank you. Good morning.
Hi, nice to be here.
Rosalind, do we have any idea why we dream? All of the early psychiatrists had theories, Freud, Adler, Jung, etc. Did any of them turn out to have been close to the mark?
Not really. As a matter of fact, why we dream is probably the question we're still researching. We do have two very strong hypotheses, though, that have gotten a good deal of support. And they're not contradictory. They could be blended into one grand theory. Those are that we dream to select from our waking experience those bits that need further attention, emotional leftovers, if you like. And we dream throughout the night from one REM period to the next, rapid eye movement period to the next, working on that issue. And we relate it to older memories and come out at the end of the night with a better feeling that we have now changed our perspectives and think we can cope with this. So one of these major new theories of why we dream is that we are working on selecting and saving important new learnings so that we can have them more accessible when we wake up the next morning.
Although some dreams are rather banal, others are a lot more vivid.
Oh, yeah. Well, some are. If our life is swinging easy and we have no troubles whatsoever, you kind of get a night off for good behavior.
What about,
and then you can play around.
What about nightmares? Are they simply negative, scary dreams, or are they more complex than that?
Well, you know, there are nightmares and nightmares. The ones that really wake you up in fear are needing attention because they are interrupting that process that is a healthy one of sorting things through. You can't sort them through if you wake up scared and you're afraid to go back to sleep. So it foreshortens the normal process, and they need help. Mostly I say, you know, you don't need to change a dream or fiddle with it because it's a healthy process. It's like digestion. You don't pay any attention to it when it's working, only when it gives you a tummy ache.
Deirdre, what about studying people's dreams? When it's done in a laboratory, sleeping in a research facility, do they put they attach electrodes to your head?
Sure do.
So wouldn't that affect?
Depends on what you're looking at. If you're interested in the brain function during dreaming sleep, of course we have more and more elaborate EEG machines, but also PET scan, CAT scans, other ways of imaging the brain can be used during dreaming. Although some dream research isn't necessarily concerned with what the brain is doing. Some dream research is collecting home dream journals and analyzing them for content to see, you know, who dreams what kinds of things under certain circumstances. So for some research, we don't need to know what the exact brain details are.
But in that research involving the brain, wouldn't sleeping in a strange space with an MRI, the only MRI I ever had was incredibly noisy.
Oh, yeah, you don't sleep in those.
Yeah, I mean,
but
wouldn't it
even for EEGs, it's become very standard to have one night in the sleep lab minimum to get the person used to that, and you don't even do the other measurements during the first night of sleeping in the lab because the sleep is likely to be so much more disturbed. But indeed, the dreams collected in a sleep lab are not completely typical of dreams collected any other way. There have been studies comparing home dreams and lab dreams, and for one thing, usually in the lab studies, we're waking people up each REM period, and so you're getting a lot of dreams that would not normally be recalled, and those dreams are actually less memorable. They're blander emotionally. They have a little bit less detail. The average dream that somebody would naturalistically recall is a somewhat livelier dream, and it just depends if you're looking, if you're interested as a cognitive psychologist in all of dream content, then for theoretical purposes, you want those every single REM period dreams. But if you're a clinician that's kind of asking questions about, you know, who naturally recalls what kinds of dreams or what to do with the dreams that are brought into therapy, those ones that would be lost forever really aren't of interest for those research questions.
But even the vivid ones often fade very quickly unless you tell it to somebody.
Uh-huh.
And then there are these other dreams. I'll suddenly realize over breakfast that I had a dream but had forgotten it until then. Something has triggered my memory of it.
They come back if they're worth remembering. You know, Freud says anything that you remember is important. So the ones you do remember are worthwhile taking a look at.
Well, what parts of the brain are active when we're dreaming?
Well, what lights up is the limbic system strongly, and that's the emotional system. And the top of the brain are really high-powered decision-making and moral responsibility has gone to sleep in REM periods.
Deirdre, do people remember nightmares more often than their pleasant dreams?
Oh, sure.
Yeah, although it's essentially any more strong emotional dream. I mean, if you have a very happy euphoric dream or an overwhelmingly sad dream or a terrifying dream, any of those are going to stick in memory much more than one that's got a fairly bland emotional content.
Well, different people have different kinds of dreams. Some people seem to dream in classic Freudian terms. Others have dreams that just seem like versions of everyday life. Do we know why there's symbolism in some but not in others?
Well, it correlates with some other personality traits. The same people who have a lot of vivid daytime fantasizing, the same people who are more highly hypnotizable if you do a formal hypnotic induction, they tend to have dreams that are more vivid, more bizarre. They also just have higher dream recall. But I'm not sure that that kind of dramatic, bizarre dreams is synonymous with more symbolism. I think even sort of tedious, mundane dreams can sometimes be symbolizing something. But the stereotypically dreamlike dreams occur to people who also have more vivid daytime fantasy, or high hypnotizables, or a bit more creative.
Rosalind, do people who have frequent nightmares as children, are they more likely to have nightmares as adults?
Yes, except that as kids grow older and get more coping skills during the day, the amount of nightmaring does reduce. So, you know, somebody who's a high nightmarer, if they get, you know, really understanding how to manipulate their parents so they're not so scared of them, then they have fewer nightmares. But nightmaring has a genetic bias or vulnerability. Twin studies and family studies have shown that, it does go in family structure, higher nightmaring. It's something we pass down, but if we help our kids learn how to cope, those reduce over time, so that, you know, you go from a fairly high proportion. It's sort of normal for kids to wake their parents up with a frightening dream, but that begins to reduced through adolescence, and then through adulthood, it's even lower.
My guests are Rosalind Cartwright, Professor Emeritus in the Division of Neuroscience at Rush University Medical Center, and Deirdre Barrett, Assistant Clinical Professor of Psychology at the Harvard Medical School's Psychiatry Department. We're talking about dreams of all sorts on today's Please Explain here on WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. We invite your calls at 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. But please don't call in and describe your latest dream in hopes of having it explained to you. You can also leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. And I'm going to get to some of those comments soon. But I was wondering about PTSD. I've heard that people who have post-traumatic stress disorder usually suffer from recurrent nightmares. Is that because they're still trying to work out that powerful experience that they had that caused them to have PTSD in the first place?
Well, my theory about why we have those PTSD nightmares is that it used to be adaptive in the times when we were developing our instincts. A trauma was likely to be a wild animal attacked in the night or the unfriendly tribe over the hill invaded your village, and that it was probably adaptive to keep re-dreaming of that incident happening every night to keep yourself vigilant for it happening again. But now the kinds of traumas that we have are not ones that are likely to recur, and yet we still have this tendency to dream the trauma over and over, either literally as it happened, or a bit more bizarre, or one step worse, the thing that almost happened actually happens in the dream. And I think the kind of biological purpose is to keep us afraid it'll happen again and vigilant and trying to prevent it, but that in modern society, that's really become a kind of maladaptive instinct. And these
I've got
recurring...
a different take.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Go ahead, Rosalind.
The PTSD nightmare that recurs is because we have nothing in our memory bank to help us work it through. Those are, you know, one time only. It's a rape. It's a car accident that was nearly fatal that you've had a lot of injuries from. Those one time very, very strong events in your life, you have no good memory bank to use to connect the present trauma to older ones, and that helps them fade across the night. These one-time ones wake you up so that you don't complete a process of imagining what you could do in future to help that one through. So it repeats because you have no answer in storage. They need help. Those need a therapy.
And Deirdre, what...
Yeah, that is one thing we agree on. I think most dream psychologists would say that one-time nightmares, idiosyncratic, bizarre, metaphoric nightmares, you do better to think about what they mean and interpret them. I wouldn't try to suppress them or make them go away. They mean something, and you want to know what. But I think that most of us agree that with the post-traumatic nightmares, there's no mystery to why you're dreaming about a house fire or car accident or rape if this has happened to you. We don't need to interpret that. And that's the main time that I would advocate that you try something called incubating a mastery dream, that you think of other outcomes that you'd like to have that dream take. And most people will initially say, oh, I'd just rather wake up the second it starts. And you can train someone to do that, but it seems to have more powerful carryover effect and help people more with some of the daytime PTSD anxiety if they can come up with some other outcome to the dream. And it's very individual what would be satisfying. Some people would rather be rescued by someone else, someone a kind of an efficacy themselves where they solve the problem or fight off the attacker. Some abuse victims would rather tell off the person that used to abuse them about why this was bad than particularly have a different outcome to the incident. But whatever's satisfying for that person, if they can work through another scenario that they'd rather the dream take, And then practice this in imagery at bedtime, combined with telling themselves that if the dream happens, they'd like this other outcome. This happens spontaneously for a lot of trauma survivors as they're getting over the trauma. They'll have the nightmares to a certain point, and then they'll have this kind of breakthrough mastery dream. And the same way the nightmares are re-traumatizing the person and making them more scared the next day, the mastery dream kind of carries over and makes them feel better. And research shows there's a drop-off in the daytime PTSD symptoms. And I think that's really the main time that one should tamper with and try to change nightmares is when they are reenacting a trauma.
Russ, and you did a study of Vietnam veterans and nightmares. And their experience actually not all that different when they wake to anyone else's had a nightmare, the sweating and increased heart rate. I've always wondered whether that panic, first of all, has an effect on our health.
Not really. I mean, it fades pretty quickly as soon as you see reality that you're back safe in your own world. So that does not really take a physical toll, unless it really keeps you up at nights because we need our sleep. But it certainly does make you fearful of sleep. And the program that Deidre was talking about has been working very well. It's called Imagery Rehearsal Therapy. Mm-hmm. And it can be really a short-time therapy, starting with just teaching you a little bit about now you're not getting enough sleep and why sleep is good for you. It's sort of convincing you that you need to work on this. And the second step is to ask you to kind of take any good experience that you've had, something you really like, and imagine it, not related to the nightmare. Just practice enlivening an image, like you're lying on the beach and you can feel the sand with your toes and the sun is warm and the sky is blue. I mean, that you really enliven a very pleasant image, and you learn how to do that on demand. I can turn that image on after I've practiced it a few days, you know, but do it several times a day to get used to. I can turn on a pleasant dream. A pleasant imaginary scene, then you're ready to tackle a nightmare. And at that point, you can do things like Deidre was mentioning, to imagine a scene with another solution to the nightmare. I mean, if it was that a bomb blew up in your vehicle or blew your vehicle up and your best pal died and you were carrying the body back to a aid station, I mean, that's pretty bad. How can you change that into a positive dream? Well, that one, you know, is tough, and you have to work with those people to say, look, this is your dream. It's very unpleasant. It's up to you to change it. You made it up. You can create a new one. And once they get that sense that it's not happening to them, nobody is forcing them to repeat that, I can change it. They can say, well, in that dream, I'm going to say that bomb really did not hit us directly. I'm going to drive right through the road safely. And, you know, if they practice that, then the ability to stop that repetitive nightmare is very likely to be in their own control.
A listener on a more prosaic level says, I sleep with the radio on, and I often find that I'll dream about whatever the topic or people being discussed. Do our surroundings influence our dreams?
Yeah. but the reason why they do is, you know, if you're playing the radio all night, you're going to be sleeping more lightly. You'll be closer to wakefulness. Mm-hmm. And if you are in stage 1-2 sleep, you can hear and respond to outside stimuli. So, you know, you will hear the fire engine pulling up to your front door, and then it's time to get up.
Yeah. But even in rapid eye movement sleep, in dreams, people sometimes incorporate sounds, including language. And, I mean, people have been talking since the movie Inception came out about, you know, how could you control other people's dreams, and certainly not with the sci-fi equipment that they have in that film. But if you had a sleeper right there and you were trying to influence their dreams the way the crew is in Inception, it actually would be something very close to a radio speaking things. That would not always get incorporated into the dream, but sometimes you'd see the content showing
and,
up.
And often
dream.
We'll hear an alarm clock go off in a dream, and it turns out the alarm clock has gone off in real life, and that wakes us up.
You said that isn't an alarm clock. That's somebody playing a radio someplace else. And go right through it. You know, you will hear the noise, but interpret it in a way that lets you keep sleeping.
This is just a dream. I've had dreams where I've thought, well, wait a minute, this is just a dream. Diane from Brooklyn, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I'm calling in because I'm wondering how medications like malaria pills make dreams more vivid. It's an experience I've had, and I don't understand it.
And another listener wonders about certain foods like lobster.
Well, I don't know about lobster, but certainly valerian root, which people often take to induce sleep, has a reputation of making dreams more vivid. Not that they will change the dream, but that they're more they're clearer. You see them in great detail and with lots of color. I am not sure that anybody has taken that into the lab to see why, what happens. But I've heard it over enough.
Were you asking about malaria drugs?
Yeah, that's what the listener asked about.
There's one called Larium, which has even daytime hallucinations as a uncommon side effect. But it is especially prone to causing nightmares and other very vivid dreams. That's a common side effect of that one. And I think all of the things for malaria have some tendency to cause nightmares and in general just to cause more bizarre vivid dreams.
What about some of the other things that people take? For example, if you drink alcohol before you go to sleep, or if you smoke marijuana, will they have an effect on dreams?
Most psychoactive drugs have some effects on dreaming. Alcohol tends to suppress REM sleep while it's actually in your system, so that you're dreaming less in the first half of the night, but then you have a REM rebound for the second half if it's a modest amount of alcohol, and the next night if it's been a really heavy amount of alcohol. So you'll get more vivid dreams, including a higher potential for nightmares as the alcohol is coming out of your system.
People who take alcohol for sleep induction, you know, to make them sleepy, find that once it's metabolized about halfway through the night, they also wake up and have to go to the bathroom from all that alcohol.
And then they find it hard to get back to sleep.
Let's take another call. We have Robert from Hicksville on the air.
Yes, I'm blind. I used to be able to see. I lost my sight gradually over the last 20 years, and I'm curious as to. I still dream of things from my childhood, but in recent dreams, I still dream visually, but it's people I don't particularly recognize. They're friendly, but I don't recognize them.
Yeah, when you've got a memory bank.
Yeah, the finding is that people that have had sight even up till age 2 continue to have lots of visual imagery in their dreams. Obviously, people blind from birth don't really have a concept of what seeing is, and their dreams are all tactile, sounds, a sense of space, but it's not visual. But yeah, if your visual cortex has had time to form, it seems to continue to be quite active in dreaming, and yeah, exactly like you say, not just reproducing things it's seen, but generating visual imagery of things never seen.
Are there archetypal dreams? Many people will talk about having dreams of showing up to take a final exam for class, but they can't find the room. Another is appearing in public naked, or those falling dreams. Do they occur to people all over the world?
Yes, they do, because we have all over the world the same developmental milestones or steps that we go through. If we're human, we all have to learn how to get up on 2 feet and walk, and so we fall down a lot, and falling down hurts, and when you have an experience that hurts, you remember it. And so that dream will repeat whenever you feel unstable in your environment for whatever reason. You know, when you're a little bit going beyond what you should in terms of the normal rules of gravity, you know. And the exam dream, which is so common, you know, it may be different in different cultures, but it's, are you living up to your own standards? Are you really sabotaging yourself by not going to class in our culture? And it may be sabotaging yourself in other ways in other cultures. But it,
yeah, the exam dream, there's some anthropologic studies. It doesn't show up as an exam in hunter-gatherer societies. It's pretty ubiquitous to the Western world. Although, even within the Western world, there's subgroups like people who wanted to be actors since they were very young. They don't have an exam dream per se. They will tend to have an audition dream, you know, where you're supposed to be doing this audition and you've forgotten where it is, et cetera. But in the hunter-gatherer societies, it's more different yet. I mean, there are tasks that you have to pass, but they're not a sit-down and take an exam. So
no,
that aspect is certainly specific.
It's the same kind of test of your ability that you have let yourself down. You haven't done what you should do to pass that test. Now, the next step is, you know, the naked on State Street dream or being in the wrong bathroom dream has to do with societal expectations of you. And those dreams are, you know, at another developmental stage. When you're incorporating, what am I supposed to do to be proper in this society, whatever that society's rules are? So it's not letting yourself down. It's sort of figuring out the cultural rules and saying, you know, am I overstepping them? Have I learned enough to make it through this society carefully?
Let's bring another caller in. Susan from Manhattan, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I have a question. I have several friends who claim they never, ever dream. Mm-hmm. Is that possible? And if it's not, I'd like you both to speak a little about repressing dreams. Thank you.
Okay, thank you for calling.
Well, there are huge differences in dream recall. Almost everyone who's sleeping the same number of hours is having the same number of dreams because the REM cycles come every 90 minutes and we're generally always dreaming. But, yeah, indeed, recall dreams vary from less than one a year to 5 long ones a night among people. And it's not clear that it's repression in the motivated psychological sense. Some people may have just slightly different biochemistry that makes it much easier to recall dreams.
Well, can we train ourselves to remember dreams?
Sure, we can.
Yes, you can definitely improve your dream recall. I mean, the individual starting differences
rules
are pretty big, but yes, you. For one thing, getting enough sleep, if you're not, will increase dream recall right there. Keeping a pad and pen by the bed, reminding yourself as you're falling asleep that you want to recall dreams. When you wake up in the morning, not jumping up or even turning your attention to something else immediately. There's a lot of research that just having to do the simplest little task before you start recalling your dreams cuts dream recall radically.
There's a step before that one. That is, when you wake up in the morning, don't open your eyes because you're going to try and stay in that REM state. And that state has muscle relaxation, profound. So don't open your eyes because you're courting that dream.
Yes.
to lie
still in the position you wake up in.
And no. You have to not move because you need to rehearse before you open your eyes the last image you can remember and give it a verbal title. Once we have a verbal tag for a dream, the rest of the dream tends to come back much more fully. If I dream, say, that's my dream of my date with Robert Redford, I can remember the rest of it. Then I can wake up fully and write it down.
Now, we don't have any time left, and I didn't get a chance to ask you about talking in your sleep or acting out dreams or even sleepwalking, but are they all dream-related?
No.
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 That's the short answer, no.
15 seconds.
REM behavior disorder is moving in REM sleep, and people hurt themselves much more easily if they're acting out dreams. Fortunately, that's rare, and most sleepwalking occurs in other stages of sleep. Sleep talking can occur in any stage, but most of it is not during dreaming.
Well, people do sometimes say, no, 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 or whatever. It must be connected to a dream.
Sometimes, no. Sometimes it's just out of a dim, unpleasant experience in another sleep state, but sometimes it has a whole dream scenario there behind the scenes.
Well, this has been a dream segment for me and not unpleasant at all. I want to thank the both of you so much for being with us. Deirdre Barrett, Assistant Clinical Professor of Psychology at Harvard Medical School Psychiatry Department, author of Supernormal Stimuli, How Primal Urges Overran Their Evolutionary Purpose from
and
Norton.
Actually, the Committee of Sleep is what I've been talking
okay.
about.
Okay, well, Rosalind Cartwright.
Nothing about dreams, although people may like it.
Rosalind Cartwright, her book is from Oxford, and I want to thank the two of you so much for being with us. On Monday's show, join guest host Julie Burstein, who'll kick things off by looking into the state of America's largest tech company, the omnipresent Google. And then Heidi Ewing and Rachel Grady, directors of the HBO documentary 12th in Delaware, discuss what's going on in the front lines of the abortion rights battle. Plus, Rick Moody talks about his ninth book, The Four Fingers of Death, and we'll examine just what kinds of chemicals and toxins are found in everyday cosmetics like self-tanners, shampoos, and face creams. The Leonard Lopez Show is produced by Blake Neeschick, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. We had help today from Adam Delahanty, Matt Joseloff, and Andrew Katchen. Debbie Fountain was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopez, your host. Thanks for listening, and have a great weekend.